Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. Here's your host, Brother Robert Johnson.
This is episode 384. Welcome back. So the news, of course, we dropped the MasonicInstruction.com website in the last episode. I hope you guys all have had a chance to check that out. We're adding new speakers all the time. I mentioned it on the Masonic Roundtable as well. MasonicInstruction.com is where you can go to schedule a national or global speaker to come to your lodge, and most of the time, these guys are not asking for anything except for the lodge to cover travel expenses. So please check that out. If you need a speaker at your local lodge, there are plenty of gentlemen ready and willing to travel and give you guys some amazing education, so check that out. That, again, is MasonicInstruction.com. And just as a reminder, I don't manage anybody on the website. I've just put it together as a one-stop shop for everybody to go and check it out. We'll get to this week's paper and theme in just a moment. The Whence Came You podcast is brought to you through the generous support of Masonic Revival, contemporary Masonic designs made for today's Freemason. You don't have to settle for throwing a plain old square and compass on anything anymore. Now you get something truly designed and truly wonderful. Whether it's aprons, awesome pins, and wonderful neckwear, bow ties, ties, pocket squares, you name it, Masonic Revival has it. Head on over to MasonicRevival.com and check out what they have to offer. If you use promo code WCY at checkout, that means free shipping also. And make sure if you see Brother Edgar, tell him thanks for helping bring this program to all of you. And this program is also brought to you by all of you, those of you who support this program. We can't do it without you and your donations and all of your assistance, so thank you so much. To find out more about how you can assist this program, head on over to WCYpodcast.com and click on Support the Show. There you can make direct donations, sign up to be a monthly contributor, a fellow, or even a producer. And thanks very much to everybody for donating. Now, before we get into the program, I want to ask you all if you would do me a huge favor. We have been the top downloaded Masonic podcast for a while now, and it's wonderful, and I thank you all for that. What we'd like to do is increase some of the presence on YouTube. So if you can share our YouTube channel or head on over there and give the channel a like or a subscribe, subscriptions would be preferable. That way, if we hit a certain number of subscriptions, YouTube opens up some cool capabilities for us and unlocks some things that we can do, like access special studios and things, which would enable us to create more and better content for the Whence Came You podcast. So please head on over to the YouTube channel and subscribe. This week's paper is a doozy. It is about the Morgan Affair, and I hope you all enjoy. Let's dig in. Morgan, The Working Tool of the Anti-Masons, by Robert Pierce. The American Climate in 1826. It was July 4th, 1826, only 15 years following our Declaration of Independence, that Thomas Jefferson and John Adams passed from the American scene. We were concluding a half century of American history and progress, which had seen the arrival of Fulton's steamboat and Whitney's cotton gin, the opening of the Erie Canal, ushering in the great canal building era, and our rapid westward expansion, a result of the Louisiana Purchase, and as evidenced by the addition of 11 more stars to our nation's flag. During that 50-year period, we nearly came to blows with France, waged war on foreign soil at Tripoli and in Florida, which still belonged to Spain until 1819, and had to fight the English a second time to secure our independence. We had created a constitution containing rights never before known to man, surveyed the Pennsylvania Whiskey Rebellion, the result of a special liquor tax, and passed Henry Clay's Missouri Compromise Bill, believing such a law would bring an end to congressional battles over the admission of free and slave states. We even flexed our young vibrant muscles when President Monroe issued his doctrine concerning foreign intervention in the Western Hemisphere. Politically, the Federalist Party was fragmented and virtually extinct, leaving the country with only one governmental philosophy, that of the Democrat Republicans, whose leaders could not agree on a single issue, no matter how simple. To confirm that fact, we need only look at the 1824 election when they gave us four candidates making sure Congress would have to choose our new chief executive. Andrew Jackson led John Quincy Adams and expected to be that choice. William H. Crawford collected close to 15% of the vote, even though he campaigned very little because of illness, and House Speaker Henry Clay had been favored, but finished fourth and threw support to Adams. Frankly, no love existed between Jackson and Clay to begin with, but Clay was tapped by Adams to be the Secretary of State, which was considered a path to the White House. The hot-tempered formal general instantly cried foul, claiming a deal had been prearranged and the election stolen. Thus, we have the backdrop, which by 1826 set the stage for one of our most exciting and fast-paced eras. And it was in that year in the western New York State that events began unfolding unto an incident which was to become a political tool for a few power brokers in their plans to defeat the uncouth Jackson and those unruly Democrats. Although short-lived as a political force, the organization which was formed left its mark on both American history and Freemasonry. And to better understand what that means, let us refresh our memories as to the incident in question. The incident which created what we now know as the first major third party in American politics, the Anti-Masonic Party. The Morgan Episode. A man named William Morgan, living in Batavia, New York, and supposedly a Mason, had announced his intentions to publicly disclose in print all of the great mysteries and secrets of the Society of Freemasons. Batavia, located in Genesee County, was split between outrage and anticipation, but before any of those great secrets could be known, the man disappeared and was never seen or heard from again. Genesee County was actually referred to as the quote-unquote burned-over district because of its many religious revivals. In 1825, Congress had extended postal and other public services to Sunday, and with some recent changes regarding church establishment laws in a couple of eastern state evangelists were jumping at every opportunity to justify new revivals and to stop what they believed was a deterioration and decline of the religious influence. The Morgan disappearance could not have occurred at a more opportune moment, and Masons were undoubtedly responsible. Thus, we have the spark. Morgan that ignited the flame for yet another revival, this time an actual crusade aimed at a particular group, the Fraternity of Freemasons. Charges that the fraternity was a church substitute and its initiation a replacement for baptism sprang forth. Our meetings were called wild drunken parties. After all, Masonic growth had coincided with increased liquor consumption, and our society was condemned as a society at war with Christianity because of its pagan rituals and oaths. We were often compared to Roman Catholic Church, which much of the populace also feared. No one seemed to care about Morgan's whereabouts, alive or dead. He was enshrined as an outstanding individual of outstanding character with outstanding loving family who was destroyed for wanting to do something he knew had to be done. That was the message coming from the religious leaders and revivalists. Many books and articles have been written concerning the Morgan disappearance, but because of time and diverse conditions, it is extremely difficult to determine with any degree of real truth as to what happened to this man. As an example, the Morgan episode in American Freemasonry was written by Stanley Upton Mock, who admitted spending years researching the entire episode. Reverend Mock was made a Mason in Batavia Lodge No. 475 in 1915, 2 years after he began his service as a minister for the First Presbyterian Church of Batavia in New York. He was still serving that church in 1930 when he wrote his book, which, when compared to other authors and historians, still left unanswered questions and discrepancies. Samuel D. Green, author of The Broken Seal and a one-time Mason, was Morgan's most favorable biographer, describing him as, quote, "my friend and neighbor, A man of fine personal appearance, of remarkable conversational powers, he was a native of Virginia and by trade a bricklayer, a soldier in the War of 1812, obtaining the title of captain while serving under General Jackson at New Orleans. Masons charged him with being a drunkard, but in my judgment without reason. A jovial man, he would drink freely, but he was not a drunkard. End quote. In absolute contrast to Green was the description of Rob Morris, who interviewed more than 100 persons supposedly acquainted with Morgan and the events surrounding the episode. Morris called Morgan a worthless fella, low-down, white trash, a bankrupt, habitual liar, a hanger-on in drug shops. We are probably safe to think of Morgan as a man who never owned property, choosing to move his family around as boarders. He was employed in many different professions, loved to drink, and had little schooling, but still held a natural charisma with the gift of gab. Apparently, some people liked him, and some did not. All we know for sure is that he was born in 1774, married Lucinda Pendleton in 1819, and moved to York, Canada, where he entered the brewery business. In 1803, he moved to Rochester, New York, and the following year, to Batavia. His second child was born in 1825, which was the same year that he became a Royal Archmason in Western Star Chapter No. 33 in Leroy, New York. No record has ever been found as to where he received any previous degrees, but then record-keeping in those days was poor at best. Morgan himself claimed to have been raised somewhere in Canada, exactly where he never disclosed, but apparently he knew enough to convince the brethren that he was, in truth, one of them. A short time afterward, a number of Royal Archmasons around Batavia, desiring to form a local Royal Archmason chapter, circulated a petition which was signed by Morgan. Objections were raised, which caused a second petition to circulate in its place, this time taking measures to be sure that Morgan would be excluded. Infuriated by this inference on his character, Morgan made his threat to expose the secrets of the organization, and since he had little money, he listened to his friend David C. Miller, who talked of financial rewards. Miller had established a printing office in 1811 and was a publisher of the Batavia Republican Advocate. He had been initiated 20 years earlier, but for some reason, the lodge had refused him advancement. Maybe he was thinking of revenge. We will never know, but he definitely saw a way to sell newspapers, which is why he and Morgan met with two other men, John Davidson and Russell Dyer, in March 1826 to plan the exposé and its advance hype. By September, articles began to appear in the Advocate foretelling of the long-awaited exposure of those dreadful Masonic secrets. On the night of the 10th, a fire broke out in Miller's printing office, and although the street was deserted because of the late hour, it was quickly discovered and just as quickly extinguished. Empty kerosene cans were found nearby, but responsibility for the blaze could never be placed or proved. Was it Miller personally, or was it Masons? The next night, Morgan was arrested and charged with theft, but acquitted and released only to be rearrested for a $2.63 debt. The debt mysteriously paid, he was again released, but this time spirited away by three men in a coach, evidently against his will. The official trail of the whereabouts of Captain William Morgan ends at Fort Niagara, where, we do know, he had been taken. Stories centering around his alleged murder at the hands of Masons circulated immediately, but no body was ever found. There was a belief that he received money to leave and never return, and one story told of a bolt of lightning which came down from the heavens burning him to a crisp as he crossed the Niagara River all alone. More than a year passed before a dead man washed ashore north of Fort Niagara. An inquest decreed the unknown person had drowned and that the remains were buried locally, only to be exhumed 2 days later and claimed by Lucinda Morgan to be those of her husband. The fact that the clothing and pocket contents could not be identified was immaterial. She was positive it was him, and she received much moral support from Miller and Dyer and many others, including a man named Thurlow Weed. A second jury reversed the findings of the first. Until 1827, abduction was only a misdemeanor under a New York law. And since there was no body, the only thing Masonic opponents could hope to obtain were conspiracy convictions. Three Masons who were members of the posse which arrested Morgan pleaded guilty and were imprisoned. Eli Bruce, the sheriff of Niagara County, and a Mason had ridden in the coach. He was removed from office by brother and Governor DeWitt Clinton, convicted of aiding the conspiracy, and served 2 years. Another Mason, John Whitney, was similarly convicted and served 18 months. There were 20 grand juries, which indicted 54 Masons between 1826 and 1831, but only 39 of those were ever tried. Many rewards were offered by both Masons and non-Masons, but there is no indication that any reward money was ever paid. Thurlow Weed, who assisted Lucinda in the misidentification of Monroe, swore on his deathbed that Whitney had made an 1860 confession that he and four others had drowned Morgan, but Weed claimed Whitney unfortunately died before his confession could be written and signed. The story does not contain much truth, however, since Whitney's gravestone in Chicago's Graceland Cemetery indicates that he lived until 1869. His son-in-law further dispels any confession by telling how Whitney would fly into a rage at the mere sight of the mention of Weed. Weed was a politician who had served in the state legislature and was very pro-Adams, or very anti-Jackson, depending on your point of view. He had given no thought to the Morgan disappearance until he realized its political possibilities. When Monroe's body was discovered, it was Weed who doctored it in an attempt to make it appear more, quote-unquote, Morgan-like. Whitney did admit that he alone was responsible for taking Morgan to dinner and offering him $500 if he would consent to being removed to Canada. He had promised Morgan that his family would be provided for and in due time would join him. Many years later, there was a claim that Morgan had been shipwrecked in the Cayman Islands in 1827 and that he and his children had settled in Central America. In truth, there is no documentation concerning Morgan's two offspring. We know Lucinda married Arthur E. Harris in 1830 and later moved to Terre Haute, Indiana, where they both converted to Mormonism. Harris, reportedly expelled as a Mason just prior to Morgan's disappearance, was one of those present when Lucinda identified Monroe's body. She eventually died in Memphis, Tennessee, but again, there is no information with regard to the children. The crusade turns political. As earlier noted, it is doubtful that the real and complete truth concerning this episode will ever be known. But there is no doubt as to the legacy which it left. David Bernard, a Baptist minister of 15 years, is believed to be the first Mason to desert the fraternity. He had been a member of Oneida Lodge No. 123, Utica, New York, and in 1829 authored the book Light on Masonry, which gave a detailed account of no less than 50 Masonic degrees. John G. Stearns, another Baptist clergy, had renounced Masonry in July of 1826 because of what he called an ecclesiastical difference, but that was prior to the Morgan disappearance. It was Stearns, by the way, who attempted to connect the fraternity with the Illuminati, which many believed was the force behind the French Revolution. There were two types of seceding Masons, those defecting under pressure and those renouncing it because of personal greed for power and recognition. Some claimed previous membership when there had been none, and others claimed they had once held great admiration for the order or had applied for admission. By June of 1827, Morgan had been gone 9 months without a trace, and the anti-Masonic crusades were prepared for its transition. Thurlow Weed and Charles C. Finley organized a meeting at Seneca, New York. Finney had become a Mason while studying law, but dropped both following a religious experience and became a Presbyterian minister, traveling extensively as an evangelist, telling all about his error. Weed was, of course, the anti-Jackson politician who visualized anti-Masonry as a justifiable means to an end. The union created by these two men grew and expanded quickly with the discovery of Monroe's body, which, in Weed's own words, was, quote-unquote, a good enough Morgan until after the election. It was his belief that Morgan would help re-elect Adams in the 1828 rematch, but it failed to happen, and Jackson became president. The young anti-Masonic organization quickly progressed to other states, and soon there was a call to unite nationally. This occurred in Philadelphia in 1830, but the only decision made was to meet again in Baltimore the following year, where for the first time ever a presidential candidate was nominated by a national convention. There were no nominating speeches and no demonstrations. The roll was called, and each delegate walked to the front table and dropped his ballot in a box. It took 5 such roll calls before William Wirt became the nominee. The anti-Masonic political party was now fully formed and had also created a political platform. Another first, outlining the party's stand on current issues. It consisted of 19 resolutions, all directed toward total destruction of Freemasonry. Masons were accused of subversive activities, hostility toward principles of liberty, undermining our nation's laws, serving fraudulent purposes, and, let us not forget, the accusation of aiding those who, quote-unquote, murdered Morgan. Remember what they say about politics and bed partners. Supreme Court Chief Justice John Marshall, a 3-term Grand Master of Virginia, accepted an invitation to attend and was seated near the podium. Richard Rush, who served in the cabinets of Madison and John Quincy, was a candidate for the nomination and, like Wirt, had been initiated. Wirt had received his first degree 30 years earlier but never advanced. In accepting the nomination, he refused to denounce the fraternity but instead gave the delegates 2 chances to reconsider their choice, saying he, quote-unquote, regarded Masonry as nothing more than a social and charitable group designed for the promotion of good feelings amongst its members and for the pecuniary relief of their indigent brethren, end quote. Oh, he was outraged by the alleged murder, but did not believe honorable men like George Washington could or would tolerate such an act. The other 2 parties immediately picked up the convention idea, with the National Republicans choosing Henry Clay in December of 1831, and the Democrats officially uniting behind Jackson the following May. Many anti-Masons had preferred Clay because of their strong anti-Jackson feelings, but he refused to renounce his membership, and like Jackson, he had also served as a Grand Master. It was, however, widely circulated that he had terminated his Masonic affiliation due to a lack of interest, a thought no doubt fueled by a notice in the January 7, 1832 Niles Weekly Register, which stated that he had withdrawn from Lexington Lodge on November 11, 1824. The notice had been placed by the Lodge Secretary, an apparent effort to aid the candidate. In direct conflict to the notice was a letter which Clay wrote on March 24, 1824, in which he said, quote, "If Morgan has been murdered or carried into captivity, I certainly could not approve of it, but if one or the other has been done, I presume it has been the work of some misguided individuals, which, however responsible it may be, ought not to affect the whole order. I am myself a Mason, and although not a bright one nor a regular attendant of Lodge, I respect the craft and its members generally," end quote. The letter written more than 3 years after he had supposedly quit, together with the 1852 newspaper accounts of his burial under a full Masonic ritual, belies any thoughts that this brother had thrown Masonry aside. It is also of interest to note that the anti-Masons brushed aside George Washington's membership, concluding that he had, in reality, renounced the institution since he only attended the lodge a couple of times after 1768. Of course, the party faithful either did not know or chose total ignorance of the facts concerning his Masonic activities while serving as our president. The election in 1832 was nothing short of a Western brawl between Clay and Jackson. The former, often referred to as Star of the West and the Great Compromiser by his friends, was labeled a profligate demagogue and Judas of the West by the president. In one vicious attack, Jackson branded Clay as the quote-unquote meanest scoundrel that ever disgraced the image of his God. Nothing too mean or low for him to condescend to, secretly, to carry his cowardly and base purpose of slander into effect. Even the aged and virtuous female is not free from his secret combination of base slander, end quote. Now, was that any way for one brother to refer to another? In summing up Jackson's attitude toward Clay, we must first understand that this great man had a tendency to hold grudges, and the Kentucky congressman was not his only target. The general's first vice president, John C. Calhoun, had also fallen from his favor and had resigned. It is said that Jackson, while on his deathbed, was asked if there was anything he might have left undone or failed to do, to which he allegedly answered rather strongly, quote, "Yes, I didn't shoot Henry Clay, and I didn't hang John C. Calhoun," end quote. Now, I cannot be completely certain, but assuming this story is true, it is very apparent that Brother Jackson's dislike for Brother Clay was carried to the grave. Masonry was definitely not the major issue of the election despite anti-Masonic efforts and the Democrats' many references to the fact that all three candidates were Masons. Before the campaign, Clay had maneuvered Jackson into vetoing a bill which would have continued the charter of the Bank of the United States, thus effectively creating a division between the East, which had valued the bank's existence, and the West, which believed Jackson could do no wrong. Masonic opposition was never a factor, and the final election count mandated a Jackson victory as he captured 16 states and 54% of the popular vote. Wirt had shown strength in New York, Pennsylvania, and New England, but received only 3 electoral votes from Vermont. In the South and the West, he polled next to nothing, as evidenced by Illinois, where his popular vote count was a mere 97. The anti-Masonic party had clearly peaked, and its only strength remained at the state level. In New York, men like William H. Seward, who later served as Lincoln's Secretary of State and was responsible for purchase of that barren Alaskan wasteland, and Millard Fillmore, our 13th president, had risen quickly with the party and survived. Masonic resistance to the anti-Masons. From 20,000 members and 480 New York lodges in 1825, the numbers dropped to 3,069 lodges by 1836. Only 2 lodges survived west of the Genesee River, and only 1, Olive Branch, remained in Genesee County, where the episode had taken place just 10 years before. There were no laws forbidding oaths or preventing Masons from holding public office, despite tremendous pressure to the contrary. And although no statewide Masonic investigation had been conducted, Weed and Seward had concluded that Masonry in New York was near extinction, and since the anti-Masonic party was so closely allied with the fledgling National Republican Party, on all major issues, both had very strong anti-Jackson beliefs. They launched a movement to unite the two. Thus, in the winter of 1834, they had laid the foundation for a new Whig party. The anti-Masonic party, however, did continue to flourish in Pennsylvania, where John Rittner, the anti-Masonic candidate for governor, defeated George Wolfe, a Democrat, and Mason after losing the 2 previous elections to him. Under Rittner, the General Assembly was bombarded with bills aimed at the destruction of Freemasonry. Thaddeus Stevens, the state's anti-Masonic leader, had disliked fraternities since his college days when he reportedly had been blackballed in Good Samaritan Masonic Lodge. He became the leading assemblyman and the main sponsor of many of those bills, of which authorized a committee to investigate Freemasonry, but that was countered by Masonic assemblymen who created a committee to investigate anti-Masonry. Both committees, as expected, issued nothing more than biased propaganda. The Stevens Committee, which author William Vaughan termed Stevens Inquisition, did call some 100 witnesses, including Brother George Dallas, an eventual vice president under Brother Polk, and Reverend William T. Sproles, a grand deacon of Pennsylvania. The latter infuriated Stevens with his statement that the committee's real intent was to gratify personal antipathies instead of facts. Stevens was later elected to Congress and was serving that body at the time of his death in 1868. He never did lose his anti-Masonic zeal, as evidenced by his part as an instigator in the impeachment plot of President and Brother Andrew Johnson, along with his continued verbal attacks against any and all Masons. New York and Pennsylvania had acted like twins in handling the anti-Masonic situation, but neither could approach the antagonism and venom exhibited in Vermont, where every effort was made to exclude Masons from public office, juries in the voting booth, and church membership. Here was probably the only true focus against the fraternity, and not just against Jacksonian Democrats. 2 examples of Vermont's animosity were an 1830 Masonic funeral in Danville and a gristmill partnership in Bristol. Relatives and Masonic friends at the funeral occupied one room and anti-Masons and their allies occupied another. Each group then stood on opposite sides of the grave. In the Bristol situation, one partner was a Mason and the other an anti-Mason. The mill was patronized by lodge members one week and anti-Masons the next. It is interesting to note that one of the party leaders in Vermont, Dr. Nathaniel Ives of Wellington, had been a Mason until 1824 when he was expelled for seducing his neighbor's wife. We have all heard the claim that Masonry vanished from both Illinois and Vermont, however, this is not completely true. In Vermont, the Grand Lodge had gone underground, and the Grand officers held their stations for 10 years. At least two lodges, Mount Anthony in Bennington and Rising Sun in Royalton, miraculously survived. In Illinois, the last official act of our first Grand Lodge was on January 1, 1827, when it installed the first officers of a lodge at Fever River, later known as Galena. The Lodge Strangers Union No. 14 eventually applied for a charter from Missouri and is known to have existed as late as June of 1829. 13 months later, a request to the Grand Lodge of Missouri for the charter was made by another group of Galena brethren. The proposed master in that petition, Brother Benjamin Mills, had served as Grand Master pro temp at the 1827 installation, thus indicating that the Illinois Masonic flame continued to shine ever so dimly. Therefore, I cannot help but believe that our state, like Vermont, also had its Masonic underground activity. The Territorial Grand Lodge of Michigan started operating in 1826 but ceased within the year when the Grand Master Lewis Cass recommended suspension of all activities. He also recommended that subordinate lodges follow suit, but thankfully there was one brother, Daniel P. Taylor, the Tyler of Stony Creek Lodge No. 7, who ignored the recommendation. Brother Taylor went to the lodge hall on a regular meeting night, arranged furniture, and placed a lighted candle in the window to signify that the lodge was prepared to meet. He performed these duties for 10 long years, even though he was the only one in attendance. The Anti-Masonic Legacy. With what might be called a dying gasp, the Anti-Masonic remnants in 1836 nominated William H. Harrison, who was also the Whig standard bearer. There is no accurate record of the vote he received from the anti-Masons, but he still lost to Jackson's hand-picked candidate, Martin Van Buren. Harrison did become the first Whig president 4 years later without the anti-Masonic assistance. Millard Fillmore, who had been with the anti-Masonic party from the very beginning, had followed the flow to the Whig party and became president following the death of Zachary Taylor, but he never was able to win election to that office on his own. Fillmore became the presidential candidate of another third party in 1856. His running mate, Andrew Jackson Donelson, was Andrew Jackson's nephew. This party, officially titled the American Party, is best remembered as the Know-Nothings because whenever asked a question, its members always parroted the reply, quote-unquote, "I know nothing." The party originated as a secret society in Iowa and was anti-foreigner and anti-Catholic, among other things. Many similarities actually existed between the Know-Nothings and the anti-Masonic party, since both appeared to be against more things than they favored. It has been said that while the anti-Masonic party was responsible for the birth of the Whigs, it was the Know-Nothings that caused its demise. The World Almanac lists 15 major third parties. Looking at the 20th century alone, we find such socialists as Engine Debs and Norman Thomas, and we recall the 1948 election with Henry Wallace and Strom Thurmond heading the Progressive and States' Rights. The American Independent Party with George Wallace appeared in 1968, and who can ignore Wilson's 1912 victory over Brother Taft, a result of Brother Teddy's Bull Moose Challenge? It was the 1800s. However, that gave us the populists and the greenbacks, the prohibitionists, the free soilers, the Know-Nothings, and that original third party which sprang from a localized religious crusade thanks to the misfortunes of a man named William Morgan. It is clear that Masonic opposition greatly extended itself on many local levels and made an impact throughout New England and the East, but it hardly created a ripple in the West and was next to non-existent in the South. This fact does not, however, explain why historians seem very willing to describe the Morgan episode, but suddenly fall silent as to the anti-Masonic party's historical impact. The anti-Masonic party, using the Morgan disappearance as its working tool, had burst on the scene of a very young nation, its originally claimed goal to destroy our brotherhood being lost in its aim to unite a fading Federalists and anti-Jackson elements, as well as aid the ambitious political opportunists. This party, like any other organization or group or cause predicated on pure hatred, could not survive or exist in a free nation. The anti-Masonic party had many members truly opposed to Freemasonry, but without a doubt its true and only purpose was to unseat Jackson and to create a fast highway to the political top. It did, however, leave in its wake a society of Freemasons which flourished and grew more rapidly than ever before, and maybe, just maybe, in light of some of the attacks recently experienced from various religious groups, we are again on the threshold of another, even greater period of fraternal growth. This article comes from Volume Number 7, Number 1, Illinois Lodge of Research, and the paper will be featured in the show app. Some interesting names that popped up in the paper. Obviously, if you have ever seen the movie Lincoln, which is fantastic, you find yourself rooting for Thaddeus Stevens. But perhaps you're split now, right? Because Thaddeus Stevens, while an ardent and never-ending argument for eliminating slavery, was a rabid anti-Mason. So pretty interesting there. Some other names that pop in there, of course, were Morgan's wife, later converted to Mormonism, and not, I don't think the paper said it in there, but it was interesting to note that the body that washed up on shore, actually, when she said it was Morgan, it really wasn't Morgan, it was this other guy, and they only maintained that it was Morgan until the end of the elections. Also, William Morgan's wife, or widow, eventually, I think she marries Joseph Smith. She's one of Joseph Smith's wives, so that's kind of interesting also. Now comes the point in the show where I ask you to help support this show. How do we do that? Well, we have a bunch of different ways to do that today. If you head on over to WCYpodcast.com, you can click on direct donation through PayPal, which we briefly touched on in the beginning of the program. Of course, you can make that one-time donation, or you can sign up to be a monthly contributor. Contributing $2 a month, $5, or even $10 a month, whatever you choose, really helps the program out. Of course, we have a limited edition shop where you can pick up any number of items that come direct from us. Help us out by going to MasonicRevival.com, but also we have some other affiliates that are really important. Bankers Best, one of the most unique things we've ever done, is to work with Brother Levi Banker out of St. Louis, who owns his own company called Bankers Best Beard and Skincare. He's been so generous. If you head to WCYpodcast.com, click on More, then click on Banker's Best, and you can check out a bunch of the different products he's got. He's got a whole line of beard care products, skin care, oils, balms, all of this stuff, and he has been doing it a long time. He knows a lot about it. Everything is handmade, quality items. We even came up with the King Solomon's Reserve Beard Balm, which is a few years old now, but remains one of the great products that he still offers. Even the artwork on the bottle was done by a brother. The nice thing about this particular product is 50% of the proceeds come back to the program. If you're a history guy like me, then you'll be pleased to know that what makes the beard oil and balm very special is that it was made utilizing the fragrances specific to the exports of King Solomon's time and location, which is amazing. So black fig and honey is the formula. Luxurious scent, as Levi says, truly fit for our first Grand Master. If you use the promo code BBWCY357 at checkout, you'll also get a little bit of a percentage off. Please check that out. Bankers Best, or just head on over to buybankersbest.com. We also have a code with On It. You can go to our website, click on More, then go to On It, and you can click through any of the links here, or just go to onit.com and use the promo code WCY at checkout. You'll get 10% off, and they'll send a little bit back to the program to help us out. And of course, it's business time. The book that I wrote with John T. Ruark, it is making some real waves, and people are using it and seeing success. So check that out on Amazon. You can click right to it. You can get it on Audible, Kindle, or in print, even on iBooks. And last but not least, I want to ask you to check out the Great Books program. You'll see the banner for it on the left-hand side, Intellectual Linear Progression. Use the promo code WCY, or you can just click on that link there, and you'll actually go right to the website and hear a little bit from Scott Hambrick about how awesome the program is. So that's it. I hope you guys enjoy, and thank you so much for helping us out. One of the more interesting things that we're going to be launching very soon is Skull and Crown Limited. Some of you have received stickers or little cards in your packages or thank you notes when you have helped support the show that shows Skull and Crown Limited. What's the website? What is it, really? Well, Skull and Crown Limited is my attempt at bringing fine stationery supplies to the fraternity. things that are branded more on the occult side of things, symbology, but more crafted. And I'm not looking to invent anything new. What I'd love to do is to design some greeting cards and paper for our brothers out there. But more importantly, my main project right now is bringing a specific product to the masses, which I think will be beneficial to anybody and is not necessarily tied to Freemasonry at all, other than myself, a Freemason, is the proprietor of the business. It's a business that's under the WCY LLC, and I would just say that stay tuned for some great announcements coming over the next few weeks. Of course, if you are following Skull and Crown Limited on Facebook, great. If not, find them on Facebook. You can just search us, Skull and Crown LTD, and you should find us. We don't update a whole lot. This is, of course, a brand that we are just starting. It's kind of a startup, so it's just in the beginning stages. So thank you in advance to everybody who will show some support there. In other news, we're going to be moving all of the Masonic Curator videos to the WCY channel. Masonic Curators was a really great project. We did 50 episodes. We had some guests come on. I considered it very successful. We have people who are still subscribing to that channel. I'm not going to take that channel down, but I am going to slowly release a new video every couple days until all 50 are on the Wentz KMU channel, which is kind of a thanks to anybody out there who is going to subscribe to the channel. So just for you guys, thanks very much. And also, what we'll do is we'll create some additional YouTube content. And one thing that I would love to do would be to put our remastered Manly P. Hall lectures. I can put them out on YouTube, but we're going to reserve doing that until we get to the 5,000 follower mark. So if we can get to 5,000 followers, I can release those, and we need to push it up to the 10,000 subscription mark. Once we get that, we can release even more stuff and take advantage of those great benefits that YouTube decides to lock away until we're super popular. Again, this show is the top downloaded Masonic podcast in the world as a podcast, not on YouTube. But now that our podcast is available on YouTube, we can build that up and take advantage of the tools that YouTube can give us. And of course, that is Masonic education. That's all we're trying to do, is push Masonic education everywhere. And we do it one like at a time, one share, one subscribe. We do it by everybody out there who helps support this show. And we could not do it at all without you guys, really. So huge thanks again to everyone who participates.
Hello, Wentz KMU fans. This is Brother Joe Martinez from Manassas, Virginia. Your illustrious host, Brother Robert Johnson, has allowed me to take a few seconds of his program to remind you about our very special event, the inaugural Mid-Atlantic Esotericon, which will be held on June 15, 2019 at Manassas Lodge No. 182 in Manassas, Virginia. This all-day event will include both tiled and untiled presentations from many of your favorite esoteric authors and speakers, to include John T. Ruark, Frater O., Greg Kaminsky, P.D. Newman, Pierce Vaughn, Jamie Lamb, Don McAndrews, and your very own Robert Johnson. Vendors will include the ever-popular Masonic Revival and Ascended Masters clothing. Lunch will be catered, with coffee and snacks available throughout the entire day. Tickets have been selling quickly, and we do have a limited seating capacity, so do not miss out. The Brew Night on June 14th is already sold out, and tickets for the event will be sold until we run out, or April 15th, 2019, whichever comes first. For more information, visit us on Facebook at facebook.com/MAEsotericon, or to purchase tickets, please visit tinyurl.com/MAEsotericon, or search eventbrite.com for Mid-Atlantic Esotericon. If you're looking for a more introspective, thought-provoking, and deeply engaging way to start your summer, look no further than the Mid-Atlantic Esotericon. Again, tickets are going very quickly, so get yours today. And as always, thank you to my dear brother, Robert Johnson, for this time to promote what will certainly be an event to remember.
Before I leave you this week, I just want to remind everybody to please check out the Masonic Roundtable. We go live every single week, Thursdays at 9:30, 8:30 Central. Interact with us live on YouTube. Please check out the Midnight Freemasons, where we publish 3 articles every single week, Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. And if you'd like to meet in person, fantastic. Let's do that. Where and when can we do this? So on March 19th, I'll be at Gateway Lodge number 40 in St. Louis, Missouri. And then after that, I'll be the end of March. I'll be in Victorville, California, doing Esoterics 101. And I may even be able to do a few other lectures. We'll see how that goes, how late the night may get. And then nothing really going on until April, when we have the Ezekiel Bates Masonicon. And I'm not doing any speaking, I'm just going to be hanging out. So that's where we're going to be in the next few months after that. We've got several dates checked out, and you can look at that on our website, wcypodcast.com. Click on presentation schedule, and that's where I'll be. Of course, I'll have copies of my books. It's business time, and that's it. So thanks, everybody, for listening. And until next week, stay on the level. For Whence Came You, I'm Robert Johnson.
You've been listening to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry with your host, Brother Robert Johnson. Be sure to join us for our next edition.